Hello and welcome to another episode of Unfinished Business, the podcast that ordinarily talks about Wrexham Football Club, but occasionally, only occasionally, ventures into the world of business in the web and creative services. So I'm your host, Andy Clark, and joining me is my friend...
Rich Rutter. Hello. Nice to be back on the pod with you and looking forward to not talking about Wrexham this time.
We have to talk about Wrexham a little let's get it out of the way first of all. The big news, of course, is that we've drawn Chelsea in the fifth round of the FA Cup at home. So that's going to be fun.
That'll be exciting.
That'll be fun. I think a couple more wins and we'll be our way.
Excellent.
We're not going to talk about Wrexham, and we're not going to talk about the fact that I've got raging toothache, so I've got to go to the dentist again on Monday.
That's joyful for you.
Not particularly. You know, it's like spending money to have something, you know, removed, potentially, is, they should pay you, like the tooth fairy.
Absolutely.
So speaking of things that I was curious about since our last conversation, how's Web Day Out going?
It's coming up very soon. 3 weeks, 4 weeks, something like that. I've still got my talk to just about finished. It's ticking along nicely. We have still got a few tickets left.
Well, have you got a promo code for...
Yeah, use CLEARLEFT10, you can get 10% off the price. Web Day Out's a day telling you all about what you can do in browsers nowadays without needing to use frameworks and all the rest of it. So there's JavaScript and CSS and all sorts of magic APIs that are beyond me, but I can't wait to find out more about.
Cool. So, what happens if you use CLEARLEFT 20?
Yes, but CLEARLEFT 20 isn't one of them.
I always do that. You know, when you kind of like, you know, sign up to our newsletter and you'll get 20% off your first order, and it's always something like new 10. And I'm always like, yeah, let's try new 20. Well, every now and again, it works. I've been in Germany for the last couple of months. And one evening, Alex and I were just kind of chatting away. And we were talking about the miserable state of social platforms. And Alex had this really good kind of thesis that social media isn't really social anymore. It's just media. You know, it used to be back in the old days that I'd share a picture of my breakfast and people would comment and go, nice sausage. But now...
And Jeremy Keith would say when he's eating toast.
Yeah, exactly. Or going to Japan, be right back.
Yeah.
It quickly turned into, you know, whether it was the algorithms or the business models or whatever, but it just turned into a place where people just kind of perform. And if you want to get anything noticed, then, you know, you have to post things 10 times a day, you know. It's just, anyway. So we were sort of bemoaning the state of social media, and I was talking about, Sue was asking, you know, do you still share stuff on Instagram? You know, because I've got my personal one, which I do post pictures of the sauerkraut that I'm just about to eat. And I've also got the business one, which, to be honest, I don't think I've updated in forever, because I had a spate where I would post new stuff, things that I was working on or whatever. And I might do it every couple of days or so. And it got absolutely zero traction at all. Nobody really was interested or commented or did anything at all. It did me no good. So I was just sort of thinking to myself, wouldn't it be good if there was some sort of platform where you could just post one thing and only one thing every day? Something that you were working on, or it could be a sketch or a layout or a graphic or whatever, but there was no kind of public follower accounts, no comments, no algorithm, no public like counts, or, you know, all this kind of stuff. But, you know, it was just a way of kind of sharing something, and it almost be like, for me, it would be like a kind of a visual diary of the stuff that I'm working on. Because you know what it's like. You get to the end of a project, you've made 100 things, but only one of them ever gets seen. So I thought, well, why don't I build it? So I did. And a little bit of a spoiler alert, I did the back-end coding using AI.
You vibe coded it.
I vibe coded it. Is that actually a term? Is that what we call it?
We don't have to say it again.
Yeah, no, I used a combination of DeepSeek and then ChatGPT's new Codex tool. And I built an app in the evenings in a week, which involved things that I've never done before. You know, obviously, I kind of designed the front end. I built the front end. I built all of the templates and, you know, did all of the HTML and the CSS. And I put all the accessibility stuff in and, you know, all the stuff that I'd like to do. But to make something like that work, it needed more than I could do. It needed a database. It needed SQL queries to create tables and, you know, manipulate content inside the database. It needed JavaScript to, not for front-end stuff necessarily, although, you know, it displays things, but often for pushing things in or out of the database. It needed a membership system. It needed the ability to sign up and join and edit your account and upload an avatar. It needed the ability to be able to only post one thing every 24 hours. A like functionality, but not if you're not logged in, not if you're not following somebody. It needed a following and unfollowing. It needed an admin thing where I can go on and delete stuff. It needed a table in the database where I've got reserved terms or reserved usernames so that, you know, people can't put F off or use, you know, admin or support or help or whatever. All this stuff, which, you know me, I'm a designer. So I've got no idea how to do that kind of stuff. But using that tool helped me build this, what I suppose we call an MVP or a proof of concept or a whatever, in a week and a week of evenings. And I know that it's not perfect, but it allowed me to get something off the ground, whether it's, you know, scalable or other people want to use it a lot or whatever, it doesn't really matter. But it allowed me to do that in a very, very short space of time with a bunch of rudimentary skills. And I was absolutely dumbfounded. So if anybody wants to look, it's at Sholio, Sholio.app. You can go to sholio.app/signup and you can bypass the waiting list. And it's changed my thinking about when and where these tools might fit into my workflow. Not just for, you know, building silly apps, but for designing and building and prototyping and doing all that kind of stuff. So I thought that might be interesting to talk about. And then I noticed that Sam at Clear Left had actually written an article on your or his philosophy for when AI tools would be relevant. So I thought it'd be a good thing to talk about.
Yeah, Sam's article is worth a read, I think. We don't have an official line at Clear Left. We have talked as a group around AI and use of AI and what we think is generally appropriate and what is wasteful and exploitative, and talked about the ethical difficulties with both how essentially all the copyright infringement, as far as I'm concerned, that has been necessary in order for AI to be able to do what it can do, like in order to be able to code something up like you just described, it's either getting it from people's code or it's getting it from tutorials or both. And it's like there's some prior human effort that it's sucked up. But anyway, that aside, yeah, Sam's article is quite interesting in terms of his sort of approach. He's quite conservative in terms of his use, small c, but looking for those opportunities which are absolutely there for, in his case, speeding things up. It's like, can AI do this something that I know how to do anyway, but can it do it quicker for me? So because I know how to do it, I can look at it once it's done it for me and check that I think it's fine. Meanwhile, I can be getting on with something a bit more valuable than just trotting out stuff that I know how to do already. Then something else could churn it out for me. So that's kind of his approach. Your use, I say, is that, but it's turned up a bit further because it's gone into an area that I would say, in your defense, if you had enough time, you'd be able to find out how to do yourself. But why? Why bother? You can do all the fun stuff like designing the product, not just, you know, what the purpose is, how it works, and then what it looks like, and then just get something else to actually make it work for you in a rudimentary way. I think that's pretty cool. I mean, that is something of a game changer.
I think there's an interesting dichotomy because, you know, there's an awful lot of talk about the copyright infringement and where these things get their information from and the environmental aspects of it, which are obviously, you know, very, very fair points. And I enjoy Instagram and other platforms less and less because, you know, did that gorilla really just, you know, wear a tutu and dance with Rudolf Nureyev? You know, probably not. AI slop is slop, and yeah. You know, I don't want to go anywhere near it. But in terms of the coding aspect, Alex had a very interesting attitude to this, which was Alex specializes in a certain field of geology to do with earthquakes, and people have written papers on this particular aspect of geology, and there's, you know, thousands of them all across the world. People have written these papers, but there isn't a central index. There's no kind of definitive guide to mélanges. So if somebody did write a paper about the mélange on Anglesey, there's no relationship to anything else. So Alex thought, well, maybe it would be a great idea if we had that kind of facility. So how do you go about that? Well, first of all, you need to get your hands on the papers, and they're all available, but they're not publicly available, and they are pretty much, you know, copyrighted. Then you've got to read all of the papers, and you've got to make this index. So Alex thought, well, this could be a good opportunity for an AI to actually do this job. But I don't want to upload all of my things to a Chinese server or to ChatGPT. In fact, I probably would be frowned upon in the academic field. So Alex persuaded the university to spend a few thousand euros on a machine that was dedicated to running AI models. Bought a graphics card that was more expensive than my entire laptop, and actually runs an AI model locally, so can get hold of the papers, can Yep. feed it in, has written the queries, written the prompts to be able to put these things, you know, query all of these things and to answer questions and to pull indexes together and all this kind of stuff. And Alex's thought was, well, you know, yes, this is something that I could do, but it would take years. It's also something that I could hire a team of interns to do. This is the kind of morally tricky part. But again, that would take, you know, more time and more, you know, potentially more kind of margin for error. So has been working on this kind of AI geology thing, which apparently is not something that universities are really kind of looking at, which I thought was interesting. But Alex's kind of thought was, well, it is just like somebody that I'm delegating the work to somebody else, except that the work I'm delegating it to an artificial person, not a real one. And they can do it faster and cheaper and probably more accurately than I can. So I thought, how does that kind of work within my workflow? And, you know, building this app, I was essentially saying to my artificial developer, I want to do this. You know, I designed it all up, you know, and I'd written it all out. And it's like, I want somebody to be able to fill in this form, join it, get a magic code, get an email, go to this page, do this, do the other. Give it a fairly kind of comprehensive set of instructions. And then it would come back and say, this is how you do it. Or in the case of Codex, it would say, okay, I've put all of those scripts together for you. And then you would look at that output and I go, yeah, that's not quite what I was thinking. Can you do this? Or you'd look at the code and go, yeah, there's no alt text on that image. And it would always say, oh, you're right. That was an oversight.
Tedious thing about all of it. Yes.
So I kind of think of it as like, literally, I'm talking to it like I'd be talking to somebody with a beard that was sat next to me.
Yeah. Well, and that got me thinking just now about this scenario where you've designed and built this app. If you were to have done that 10 years ago, let's say, what would your process have been? I mean, you probably would have had to find a friendly developer who was interested in the challenge and up for giving their own time for helping you put it together. I think that would have been the solution. It's not like you're going to go out and get funding for it.
No.
Or something like that.
I think my plan would be if it gets too popular for just my kind of rudimentary implementation and it needs to scale a bit or there are some major issues. Yeah, I would love to find a developer that at this stage would be prepared to put as much time into it as I'm putting into it. You know, for a kind of a, I don't know whether you call it co-ownership, but, you know, it would be like a kind of a project. Or you kind of just open source it.
And hope.
and hope.
Yeah.
So, that would be my kind of plan. I wouldn't see that, you know, I'm fully aware that this thing has not got production code written all over it. But in this particular instance, I think I'm okay with that.
Yeah, it seems like, I agree. I think it seems a perfectly valid use of the tool. And it's, you know, it is exciting that you can do that kind of thing now, particularly if you can look at it from the point of view, I'm not really putting anyone out of a job because I wouldn't have been paying them anyway. Maybe someone might have joined in and helped, but at the same time, I'm still asking quite a lot of them, which they may or may not get back other than the sheer enjoyment of a challenge.
Yeah.
It all seems reasonable to me.
Yeah. But the idea that, you know, somebody like me who, you know, I've got my design skills, but I also kind of understand the workflow. I understand the accessibility stuff and all those other things. So it's not like I'm just saying to it, give me this and never checking the output. But to be able to put something together and get it out there kind of just, you know, it just reminds me a little bit about the original kind of fun that we had with the web. And probably if I hadn't have had the opportunity to work with AI to get that back end stuff done, then it would have just stayed a few sketches in my sketchbook.
Yeah. Unlocks things like that, doesn't it? It is good from that point of view. Like, there's a tiny little tool which is a property in CSS, font size adjust, and the number that takes is a aspect ratio. So you need to look at a font and you need to work out what the ratio is between the height of an X and the height of the... Anyway, and that varies from font to font, which is sort of the whole point. And I've got the tool so far, and it will work with a font file on a URL somewhere or on a local file. But what I really want is to be able people to be able to drag, and for me to be able to drag a font onto that, like you can do in something like Wacomai Fondue. And I've no idea how to do that, but I'm pretty sure, aside from making it open source and asking around and like, can someone make this work for me? That actually I could probably work out how to do that in an evening with the help of an AI, because it's a pretty common thing to be able to do.
And I'm sure that, you know, the more you work with something, the more familiar you're going to get with it yourself. So, you know, you're going to be asking fewer questions.
Yeah.
You know, I've been using AI coding tools in a couple of different ways. I noticed that Sam was talking about documentation in the article. And because I often hand over stuff to developers, you know, I will always, my deliverable is always HTML and CSS as well as, you know, other stuff. But just the ability to be able to upload a CSS file and say, write me documentation explaining what these CSS properties are doing, you know, and it comes back with it in seconds, is, you know, I'd spend half a day writing documentation.
Yeah. And then all you need to do is you need to go through it and edit it.
Yeah.
That sort of falls into Sam's kind of first rule, which is get it to do stuff that you can already do yourself. But I did it can do it an awful lot quicker, sort of thing.
Mm.
And I think that's a good, whether or not you want to take it further than that, I think that's a good sign for actually maybe when you should be turning to AI now for those efficiencies. I certainly wouldn't want to go down the Shopify route or whatever it is and mandate everybody at ClearLeft has to use AI and they need to show me how much they've used it that day, otherwise they'll get fired, because that is just maniacal and stupid.
Tell me more about this. Give me the 5 minutes.
I'll take it. Shopify, I think Spotify. There's quite a few of these companies who have these AI mandates that are like that, where you, it's like everyone is using AI now, and if you cannot show that you are using it, and then and stuff like, how many lines of code has your AI produced so far today? And if it's not enough, then you get told off, which sounds daft, but as far as I can tell, that does seem to actually be the case in some of these companies.
God, why would you want to work there? Jesus.
Well, indeed, yeah. And meanwhile, they're busy firing people anyway. So yeah, that might be why you want to work there, because the market's getting flooded with people. Well, that's a bit of a Silicon Valley problem, generally speaking, although Spotify's not Silicon Valley, is it? But not strictly. Sweden, I think.
I don't know where they are.
Anyhow, there is still like looking out for those opportunities of productivity. Because actually, when that kind of generative stuff and things like, can you turn this text into Markdown or this Markdown into HTML for me? Or, you know, those things which are transformations, they're not particularly thirsty when it comes to the energy requirements. But when you're generating images, when you're generating video, that's when it goes bonkers and is orders of magnitude more than a bit of text transformation.
Mm. If you hired me to do a job, you hired me to do some design, my deliverable, as I say, is HTML and CSS. And I will often produce a set of templates. In the past, I've used a little Mac app called CodeKit, which is a sweet little thing. And it means that you can, you know, without having to do any PHP or anything like that, you can create variables and it will populate across templates. You can do includes, partials, so, you know, you only have to write your footer and your header once and all this kind of stuff. It's a kind of an extension to static HTML, and it turns kit files into HTML. I've used this thing for ages, and I will always deliver a bunch of templates. And sometimes there might be only a few of them, and sometimes there's quite a lot. And the more I do it, the more clients wanted to kind of almost see like a full website in a way. So if I was to produce a page about, let's say it was a services page, they would want to see what happened when I clicked on it to go to an individual service. If there was a filtering system somehow that kind of removed everything that wasn't in the category that you'd selected, then you'd have to produce multiple pages. These things could get quite unwieldy. And because they were static HTML, it meant that when I handed them over to the developer, all things like hyperlinks would all be HTML and they'd have to remove it. Or they'd have to remove a dozen templates that were just there purely to show the client how one thing moved from another.
Yes.
So what I did was I took a client project and I kind of, an 11T project, and I removed all the stuff that wasn't relevant to a kind of a boilerplate. And I created my own little starter kit, similar to what Andy Bell's done with his kind of 11T thing. And for the last couple of projects, knowing that I'm only going to be handing over CSS files, you know, SVGs, partials, page layout templates, whatever, it kind of occurred to me that instead of doing things manually and producing all of these things by hand, why just don't I use 11T?
Yeah.
So there's a new tool called Codex, which is from...
Right, yeah.
And I've used ChatGPT for bits of coding. You know, I would say to it, you know, I need a simple JavaScript that changes the color from red to green, and it would do it for me. And then I'd copy and paste that back into my project. Whereas with Codex, it's completely aware of the code base in my project. So if I say I need a JavaScript to do this, then it will, you know, just implement it.
Right.
The point being with this is that I can say, I need to create a services template. Here's the HTML that I want to use for each entry. Now go off and create me the filtering system on the categories. Within not very long at all, I will have essentially a working prototype of the website.
Yeah.
And if the client turns around and says, yeah, we don't want the filtering anymore, then I've probably spent a minute doing it. Or if they turn around and say, yeah, we want the filtering to work in a different way, then I know that it's not going to be a big deal to kind of use the tool to demonstrate how I want this thing to work. Now, you know, when I hand that over to the developer, they're probably going to take that thing apart and put it back together again in their own way.
Yep.
They probably won't use 11T. They'll change it into Craft or into something else. But for me, in terms of actually prototyping designs, it's a game changer.
Sort of.
You can do
That's what you can do. You can do that in Figma. But then, you know, designing in the browser gets you an awful lot closer to a website than Figma.
Well, and that's the point. And why would I kind of abstract the website into something else when I can actually, you know, build stuff that the web's actually made of?
Yeah.
I was thinking about this in terms of my workflow and how I think about using these tools. When I decide that a filtering is going to work in a certain way, or a transition from one element to the next is going to work in a certain way, or if I decide that I want my cowboys on my stupid website to bounce in a different way, or I want to change the background tint with some relative color depending on the time of day, which I've done fairly recently. That's design.
Yeah, it is.
And I'm able to take that design closer to how somebody's going to experience it or consume it faster and easier than I would have ever done it before.
I think it definitely unlocks that process and does speed things up.
You know, I know that there are some people going to be listening to this going, you know, boo-hoo or bah humbug.
Well, yeah, and I probably would be, but I think there's would have been maybe not so long ago. But I do see the benefits. I see those just filling in the kind of gaps in ability and just being able to concentrate on what you're doing. But you do have to have that level of knowledge in the first place. Not necessarily about the output, like you said, but like with the app that you were talking about earlier on, you know enough to be able to know that it's probably not production ready code, but it does a good enough job to probably handle quite a few people using it. But this is the thing, you've got to have a certain level of knowledge, I think, to be able to go into it, to be able to assess and also to know what to do. But that's why I think if the way that you're describing it is just a really useful tool to help design and to help build. What you're not talking about is AI, output me a UI for this website.
Yes.
That what's going on here is something much more fundamental. It's something that is helping manifest the design more quickly. But the design there, which is where all the value and the thinking is, and I don't mean that to disrespect the front-end code, because a good front-end coder is going to get things properly accessible, which is one of the big drawbacks on any code that comes out of a generator, and you're handwriting the code yourself, so that doesn't count for this situation. But anyway, there's expertise that needs to go into these things to make them production ready. But as a way of speeding up and filling in gaps for some of that process, I think, you know, it is fantastic.
And the other thing, we talked about, you know, generative images and stuff early on. You know, I would give up and start growing giant marrows if I ever got to this stage instead of working on the web. You know, if I ever got to the point where I would say, you know, create me a logo for a web design company, or a widget maker or whatever. And, you know, it comes back with a bunch of, you know, I don't use generative image AI for that kind of stuff at all, ever. But what I will sometimes do is I will sometimes use it as a replacement for stock photography. That's one thing I will use it for. If there is something generic that, you know, you just need a picture of. But the other interesting thing is, and this was when I was doing my cartoons for my own website. And I'm not, you know, I'm not a natural illustrator. I'm not John Hicks by any stretch of the imagination. So I do need help with a lot of things. I'm the world's worst person for drawing hands, which I think, you know, if I was to say to, you know, Midjourney or something like that, you know, give me a rough pencil sketch about what the inside of a gold mine looks like. And I was thinking, well, you know, in the old days, how would I have kind of gone about this? And I would, you know, I would have done a Google image search, or I'd have gone to the library and looked through reference books and stuff like that. So it is just the same kind of, it's, as a research tool, it works for me. And what I did with those things was I ended up, you know, collecting a whole load of different things. You know, some of it I would have found online or cut out from a magazine, or, you know, got an AI to generate the background of a gold mine. But then I pulled everything into Procreate on the iPad. Yep. I pulled this kind of like montage of stuff that was all glued together in a way, you know. What did an old-fashioned oil lamp look like? And there'd be a really crappy version of it. But I'd pull it over into Procreate on the iPad, and then I would draw my own version. So again, it's using it to kind of fill in those gaps in my skill or my knowledge.
I think AIs suffer from a couple of things when it comes to that. I think there's the inbuilt mediocrity, and that's how they work, because they're statistically based. So it's going to pick something which is the most likely result. And the most likely result is, you know, the average, the median, the mediocrity, which for a lot of things is fine, because that might also be the same thing as best practice. But when it comes to churning out images or something like that, it's not, it, you know, it's not going to give you anything particularly wonderful. Also, there's no taste. I think that's been mentioned a few times in a few bits of writing. But also, I mean, just worse than that, we use Google Slides quite a lot at work for presentations and reports and all sorts of stuff. And there's this feature in there now, which is beautify this slide, which uses AI's lack of taste to make your slides look even more horrific. But that, there's probably as much of a lack of taste as someone who decided to implement that particular feature and thought it was a good idea, but it does show the inherent lack of taste. In fairness, it's putting that lack of taste from the lack of taste that in its pool of training data, which is like the most people out there, in fairness.
Hey, now, when I was designing the site for Mike Worth with the orangutans, I had this silly idea at one point that I wanted to cover him in coconuts, as if, you know, all the coconuts off the trees had, like, you know, covered him up, and there he was stuck inside a great big pile of coconuts. So I could probably just about draw a coconut from memory. But, you know, I did actually say to DeepSeek at some point, you know, what would an orangutan look like if it was covered in coconuts? And do you know what? It probably not a query that DeepSeek's ever had before. Do you know, it could not draw a coconut, a complete coconut. It couldn't do it. Because every single thing that it had been trained on was a half coconut, you know, with the white on the inside and whatever. That's the picture that it thought a coconut was. It didn't know what a regular coconut looked like.
Ask enough people what a coconut looks like and you're going to get half coconuts every time.
Yeah, there's a title for this week's episode, isn't it? An orangutan covered in coconuts.
Yeah, I think you nailed it there.
I listen to what people say, you know, I listen to Andy Bell and others, and I understand all of the, you know, the concerns and the issues about this kind of stuff. And sometimes I do feel, you know, I feel bad for the developers that I would have probably used, you know, for a day's work or whatever when I'm putting a prototype like this together. So, yeah, I'm kind of aware. I still feel really kind of uncomfortable in half of me anyway. But then the other half just thinks, this is just a tool, as millions of other tools have developed over the eons.
That's right. And it's not hugely different from the scenario when the likes of Shopify and Squarespace started appearing, where people could design and put together pretty good looking, fairly substantial websites, including e-commerce and everything like that, without an awful lot of knowledge. Certainly not much technical knowledge, when before those came along, they would have had to pay quite a lot of money to the kind of design agency that would have been chucking out in volume, like lots of small websites. And that part of the market just kind of disappeared for people that didn't have an awful lot of budget, but didn't know how to go about doing it themselves. You know, there were companies that specialized in that, and Spotify and Squarespace and their likes came and ripped that market away.
Mm.
And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it's not quite the same, I think, is what we're talking about, but it's something similar.
Well, I think we should wrap that up. Can you remind me and the listeners of the discount code for Web Day Out?
CLEARLEFT10. We'll give you 10% off your ticket for Web Day Out, which is at webdayout.com.
This episode is sponsored by Web Day Out, obviously, unofficially. Good to see you, mate.
And you.